afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. And I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen, bringing you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for January 31st, 2023. Good afternoon, Dave.
Can't say that any longer. January 31st. Hello, Melody.
Happy
National Hot Chocolate Day.
Oh, yummy.
The only thing better than a hot chocolate on a cold winter day is a room temperature Hershey's bar with almonds.
Well, I don't know about that.
Yes, I know. I'm an easy-to-please chocolatier.
Ah. Well, you know, I do believe Hershey's is different than what it used to be.
Smaller.
Yeah, that's for sure. But it just doesn't, it just doesn't taste the same. It almost gives me a headache sometimes. But I do like some of their other chocolate products, though. But I can remember, I think I shared this on the program before, growing up as a kid, we would go into Hershey. We had to go through Hershey to go to get to my grandparents' house if we went the long way. And as kids, we would play this game to see who was the first one who really could smell the chocolate. Now, we trusted each other that because Hershey, going through Hershey chocolate, when they actually had the factory there, you could smell it maybe 5 miles away going into the little town of Hershey, Pennsylvania. And it was very it was very overwhelming chocolate smell. And I remember that fondly, and I can almost smell it.
The rush of endorphins as we drove down Chocolate Avenue.
Chocolate Avenue. And it was really awesome when they got the Hershey Kiss streetlights.
Yes.
You know, that was a big deal. I think they still have them.
They do.
Do they?
Yes, they do. Just there 2 weeks ago.
Oh. Yeah. They used to take me to the Hershey Park for my birthday. That's where we would go for my birthday. But anyway, let's go ahead and talk about gold and silver today. Gold was up in the New York spot price after market, $4.80. $1,928. Silver was up 13 cents, $23.81. Platinum was up $3 at $1,023. And palladium was up 10, $1,732. We had the USDX today was down 0.17 at 102.07. Crude oil was up $1.19, but still shy of 80 by a buck, almost 79.09. And the Dow was up 368 points. It struggled earlier in the day, but eventually it did turn around, 34,086. S&P up 58, 4,076. NASDAQ 190 up, 11,584. Europe markets, European markets, everything was positive. FTSE was down. Asia, everything was down, but not by much. I mean, the biggest decliner was the Hang Seng. 10-year yield was down 3.51% is the yield. And let's take a peek at natural gas was stronger, up 2% at 2.74. I remember when I was repeating that, and it was approaching $9 not too long ago. And that certainly has come down, especially since it's been getting some bad press and so forth. But I know we're going to talk a little bit about the general. And it's like, oh, this is a real shocker about these EVs. You know, it's just kind of cracks me up a little bit. But, and again, this is what we're going to talk about now. I know we got to talk about it, Dave, but it really is a joke. It really is anymore when you see, you know, all these, oh, you know, like it really is going to make a difference. And I don't know where it makes a difference at, to the positive side. I mean, so the big debate is about the Fed's rate increase. 2 o'clock tomorrow, post-meeting statement, Jerome Powell's is going to signal whether, you know, people are going to look for signs as what that answer might be. And everyone thinks the economy has improved in recent weeks. just because of the job market data. Supposedly benign inflation, but let's talk about inflation to the majority of Americans out there. And of course, this is the biggest sign of all, the stock market. So we'll have to see what he's going to do to the rates. And I think at this point, Dave, it really doesn't make a difference, but what he does.
Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting. They're certainly not going to pause. Really, up until this week, I still felt that a 50 basis point increase was plausible. Well, it still is plausible, was probable. I don't know if I can compete with the almost 99% of Fed future traders who say it's going to be 25 basis points ahead of a coming slowdown. This is all what the markets are hoping for. And I wonder how much of it is wishful thinking as opposed to, well, this is our expectation, or more so, this is what we think ought to happen. In December, just a month ago, 17 out of 19 members in the FOMC envisioned pushing rates above 5% this year. At the time, well, that still holds true today. It implies three more rate hikes, and not two, as a lot of people are supposing tomorrow and then at the March meeting. Financial markets certainly aren't buying the Fed speak. They continue, according to many Wall Streeters, to price in a pause in rate hikes after the March meeting, followed by actual cuts the second half of the year. I mean, we're sometimes I fear that we're a little too close to this in talking about it almost every day. But the reason we do is that there are so many mixed signals. It's so confusing for the everyday precious metal investor. And that's why we do, because there are just so many so much noise out there, ladies and gentlemen, that's hard to parcel out which you should be listening to and which you should be ignoring. Well, I think we can safely say that you can ignore a lot of it. Continue to tune into Financial Survival, and hopefully we'll continue giving the news that we think you need to hear, not what the other guys think you want to hear. So,
yeah, and you're absolutely correct. And some of these things that we talk about, it doesn't take away from the long term vision that we believe is accurate when we talk about it also in this program. However, this is what your financial planners, this is how they're putting together your retirement accounts. This is what they use to, beef up or take down your retirement, your pensions. Just like we talked yesterday on those environmental hedge funds that they're in your accounts. I mean, in the bond markets. I mean, there's reports out there where the debate is whether he can lower rates or keep going. Well, we see what happened to Japan. They have their rates so low for so long, they can't go higher. And that's going to be their downfall. And it's interesting. I mean, because this really is, I mean, if people believe in a reset, if people believe that we've come to the fork in the road, it's going to be interesting to see. And it's history also being made. Because nowhere else in the world has these situations have ever appeared. certainly in other countries and, of course, other societies and so forth where they've collapsed and so forth. But we're supposed to have the greatest economy ever to have been built so far. So it's interesting to see, but yeah, we all know, you know, Fed's between a rock and a hard place. It doesn't matter what they do. There's
hey, come on, it's taken centuries to build up a $31.4 trillion debt, Melody.
Yeah, but most of that was done in the past 10 years.
Well, I know, isn't that humbling? You know,
goes to show you how bad things are, that they needed that debt in order to keep it going.
Yeah. No, that's quite true. And, you know, the rock and the hard place scenario, it again plays out with the Fed's preferred inflation metric, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, down 5% in December from 5.5% the month before, annualized. But remember, that 5% is still more than double their goal of 2. So, you know, again, whether it's 25 basis points or 50 tomorrow, if it is 50, I think you can see a really big market sell-off. Stock market, certainly. Bond market will take a hit. I'm not sure about precious metals because... you know, with all the paper market traders now pushing precious metals into ETFs, it's been a little less predictable for that. But stay tuned.
Yeah, and the thing of it is, if the precious metals do fall into that category where, you know, they pull back, it's temporary. It's a knee-jerk reaction. Because where do people go when you have a market breakdown? They all go to gold. It's just now they have so many other choices, and they follow each other like, you know, whatever people follow other people at, you know. And, you know, I just saw, I don't know what I did with that, you know, where even the crypto markets, you got BlackRock in there now trying to bail out Silvergate, you know. So... they increase their stake in that crypto bank. Well, that'll keep it from failing for a while. So, you know, now you have these, you know, government investing companies like BlackRock, you know, so they're helping to keep things from failing. So they're helping with the bailouts. So, again, that goes to show you just how bad a condition the government's in our financial, because the Fed can't bail out the crypto market. So you got BlackRock in there increasing their stake holdings in the banks. So, yeah, it's just consumer confidence. You know, they're less confident than they were at the end of last year. The Conference Board reported today that its consumer confidence index slipped just a few notches. You know, 107 in January, down from 109 in December. So it's still going down. So they continue to, you know, the Business Research Group's Present Situation Index, which measures consumer assessments of current business and labor markets, that rose to 151 from 147. So, you know, they still continue to express a little bit of optimism about the stability of their incomes and the broader job market. And Dave, I think that's because we keep hearing about, you know, we can't fill job positions.
Right.
So I guess that's what makes them more, that probably gives them a little bit more, you know, confidence in their stability of their incomes than, oh, this is a great economy. You know, do you know what I'm saying? You know, does that make sense?
Know. It does make sense. Well, it doesn't make sense, but I know what you're saying. it's almost irrational that people feel that way.
Yeah.
With our economy being on the verge of recession, in fact, some sectors in it already, and it's certainly reasonable people can debate. I mean, in fact, over there's a small majority of Americans as a whole believe that the economy's been in recession. So it's a wonder some of these numbers are as high as they are.
But their expectation index, which is a measure of consumer 6-month outlook for income, business, and labor conditions, that deteriorated. So we're okay today.
Okay, there we go.
I feel real stable today, but still, I mean, it's like
that's the point, I think, to emphasize.
Yeah.
That I beg your pardon for calling you irrational, ladies and gentlemen.
No. I mean, it is irrational for the consumer out there to think this way and to think that, you know, today is okay, but tomorrow won't be. I mean, what's going to, you know, anyway, what's next?
Well, we got pay and benefits for American workers as measured by the Employment Cost Index, probably the broadest measure of wages in the country, grew at a more gradual pace in the fourth quarter. Third straight slowdown, if you will. And some are saying that that could help reassure Fed policymakers tomorrow that wage gains won't fuel higher inflation, thus presumably making them more comfortable with a lower level of rate hike and a possible pausing earlier than later. Perhaps not. Wages and benefits like health insurance grew 1% annualized in the fourth quarter last year compared with the previous 3 months when it grew 1.2%. Chair Jerome Powell of the Fed and economists consider that data known as the Employment Cost Index or ECI to be the most comprehensive gauge of labor costs. He cited last year a big increase in the index as a key reason why the Fed pushed its interest rates higher. He said he sees rapid wage gains, particularly in the service sector, as the biggest impediment to bringing inflation down to that target of 2%. When restaurants, hotels, veterinarians, and other service companies raise pay, they often pass along those higher costs by charging their customers higher prices. Melody.
Yeah. Well, we're about ready to head into a break, but you know what? All these global organizations, now they're seeing growth from this year after they come out, a month ago and said it was going to decline. So,
yeah.
But things change that fast. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csetalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back to Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody off the rest of the program to take care of other client business. 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. One word, dgscoins. .com. While you're there, don't forget to sign up if you're not already for our free weekly newsletter and blog. So, corporate boards. Apparently, they like men running their companies still. Women and girls have advanced in many ways in recent years, yet a new study shows the top of the corporate food chain, anyway, remains male-dominated. There's only one woman, in fact, among the top 20 highest-paid CEOs in the S&P 500 in 2021, a new analysis from S&P Global Intelligence shows. This year, there are 37 women chief executives leading S&P 500 firms. That's up slightly from 2021. I should say last year, 2022. Well, here were the 10 most highly paid CEOs of public companies in the S&P in 2021. The 12th highest was the highest paid woman, Patricia Kessler Poppe of PG&E, $51 million. Next, number 11, Glenn Fogel of Brookings Holdings at $54 million. 10th, Ron Clark of Fleet Corps, $58 million. Rounded, these are figures. Hock Tan of Broadcom, $61 million. Fabrizio Frida of Estee Lauder, number 8, $65 million. Number 7, our man, Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase, a mere $84 million. Tim Cook of Apple, next, $99 million. William McDermott, who's number 5, he's of ServiceNow, $166 million. Number 4, Patrick Geisinger of Intel, $178 million. Third, Andrew Jassy of Amazon, $213 million. Second, David Zaslav of Warner Brothers Discovery, $247 million. And the highest paid executive, Peter Maxwell Kern, at a cool $296 million. My newsletter article this week covers this topic in more detail, which I'll talk about in today's third segment. Now, Melody mentioned this in the first segment. Yesterday, Ford said it's lowering prices for its all-electric Mustang Mach-E. Now, analysts are saying the price war has begun amid growing competition in that electrical vehicle or EV market. Marin Gaja, a top Ford EV executive, said, "We're not going to cede ground to anyone," as an apparent stab at Elon Musk. Ford is cutting 2023 Mach-E prices between $600 and roughly $6,000, depending on the configuration and battery. Ford's the number two EV seller in the U.S., far behind Tesla, but looking to gain ground. Last year, Mach-E sales grew 45% to well over 39,000 units. And Ford also said it's now significantly increasing production. I'll tell you, I was passed by one a couple of weeks ago on a local highway, and it's a beautiful looking and sounding car, I must say, if you can afford it. Ford's move, 2 weeks after Tesla cut prices of up 20% on its Model 3 sedan and Model Y crossover, has a lot of people talking. The Vietnamese startup VinFast has also cut prices as it seeks a stake in the U.S. market. EV experts say to look for companies to bring the price of more models under the eligibility cap for U.S. consumer purchase subsidies. Ford's move boosts the number of Mach-E versions under the 55K ceiling, 80,000 for SUVs. So we shall see how this fight ensues. Oh, look, it didn't take long for the U.S. Department of Agriculture to reverse course. After reporting that the federal government raised federal food stamp benefits to an all-time high last year, the USDA's Food and Nutrition Service, FNS, announced that the monthly payments to beneficiaries would decrease starting in February. The FNS confirmed it would reduce the temporary boost in SNAP benefits after the February payment, which was approximately $95 a month on average. That is the boost, not the total average cost. SNAP, which stands for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly food stamps, provided food benefits for over 41 million Americans in 2022, who received an average monthly benefit of $231 for food. The FNS announcement read, "All SNAP households have or will see a decrease to SNAP benefits they receive when emergency allotments end in February or March 2023. USDA recently reported that SNAP cost an all-time high of over $119 billion last year. That's about double the pre-pandemic level of $60.4 billion in 2019. Now, we shouldn't be surprised by this because the periodic numbers we've seen over the last 2 years of the crazy pandemic sort of reflects what's been happening. I mean, the South is on track to become the U.S.'s population center for the first time in history. Last year, the South grew by 1.3 million people through births, outpacing deaths, and domestic and international migration. That's according to estimates from the Census Bureau. The Northeast and Midwest lost residents. The West grew by just 153,000, primarily because a larger number of people left for a different region. In fact, 233,000 people left a Western state and planted roots in a different region from mid-21 to mid-2022, and almost 868,000 people moved to a southern state from another region. Now, six of the 10 states with the biggest growth last year were in the South, led in order by Texas, Florida, North Carolina, and Georgia. immigrants are also moving south with top destinations such as Austin, Texas, and Florida cities like Sarasota, Jacksonville, and Fort Myers. And the share of black Americans living in the South is ticking up after decades of decline. More affordable homes, lower taxes, in some cases the lack of income taxes, warmer weather, state that is, warmer weather, and the flexibility of remote work are among the leading factors driving people south. Now, interestingly, I didn't know this, since the population center was first calculated to be in Chestertown, Maryland, in 1790, you know, quite a quaint town on the Chester River, it has moved continuously westward. And although it started taking a more southwestern tilt in the 20th century, as the spread of air conditioning made the South more livable. If this trend outlasts the pandemic, they say it could impact the reallocation of political power through redistricting after the next census in 2030. Story. Hey, if you're thinking of filing for bankruptcy protection, you better have a good reason for doing so. Yesterday, a federal appeals court ruled that you have to actually be broke to file for bankruptcy protection. Seems reasonable, doesn't it? The court dismissed the bankruptcy filing by a subsidiary of corporate giant Johnson & Johnson. J&J created the unit called LTL Management for the sole purpose of holding legal liabilities and then filing for Chapter 11. The ruling undercuts the emerging corporate strategy of using bankruptcy to get rid of costly liabilities when the organization itself is pretty doggone, if not perfectly, solvent. The three-judge panel said in its unanimous ruling, because LTL was not in financial distress, it cannot show its petition served a valid bankruptcy purpose and was filed in good faith. Now, organizations and companies like the NRA and 3M, for example, have been getting more creative about how they attempt to leverage the U.S. bankruptcy laws to their advantage. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals said it doesn't intend to discourage lawyers from being inventive, but it said in this case that J&J's finances just mean it has no right to access the tools of bankruptcy court, which allow debtors to, well, restructure and slash their liabilities without facing further legal action. University of North Carolina bankruptcy professor Melissa Jacoby says this is a vindication of the rule of law and the role of the civil justice system, adding bankruptcy plays a very important part in our legal system, but it's for extraordinary circumstances. Now, this particular lawsuit or bankruptcy filing, excuse me, was not over, as many people may have thought, opioid deaths. This was over 38,000 lawsuits from people and their survivors claiming that the company's talc-based powder causes cancer. J&J has repeatedly denied that allegation. Well, at the time it put the new LTL unit into bankruptcy in October 2021, J&J had an equity value of more than $400 billion. Plus, they had a AAA credit rating and $31 billion in cash and marketable securities. Fairly solvent by most measures. That means it almost certainly had ample liquidity to pay LTL's obligations and can't use the bankruptcy process instead, so says the court. When LTL filed for bankruptcy, J&J was worth at least 25 times more than its estimated total product liabilities over the next 2 years, the ruling stated. When an organization files for bankruptcy, creditors have to negotiate collectively with the debtor in pursuit of a settlement. often for pennies on the dollar in the case of litigants who are considered unsecured creditors. Well, J&J has agreed to pay or provide $2 billion through a trust to pay claims for these talc lawsuits. It's an amount the alleged victims say is insufficient. In any event, J&J said it will appeal this latest ruling, rejecting the Third Circuit's contention that the company didn't file in good faith. Thus, if the Supreme Court, well, doesn't agree to hear J&J appeal, or if it hears it and rejects it, the company will be forced to address its liabilities on a case-by-case basis in court, out of court, or through a massive civil settlement. Whew. Hey, interesting essay by Joe Wiesenthal of Bloomberg News today, who writes that the defining policy of choice during the Great Recession was to bail out the too-big-to-fail banks, noting it was a very top-down way to rescue the economy. The money went to these mega institutions, and relatively little was spent on direct transfers to, say, the unemployed or people getting evicted from their homes. When the pandemic hit in 2020, the script was flipped. The spending was more bottom-up. Major policy choice this time was around the $600 check sent to the unemployed. Meanwhile, the bailouts didn't go to banks or large corporations, at least directly, rather to small businesses, however undeserving some of them may have been through the Payroll Protection Program. Unfortunately, the GAO says $45 billion of the PPA went to fraudsters. In any event, Wiesenthal says it may be worth keeping this reversal in mind, that is, bottom-up instead of top-down, as we ponder the different headlines we're seeing these days. There's a lot of doubt that GDP growth can remain strong or positive even as all these big firms like Microsoft and Alphabet undergo layoffs. These are, after all, some high-paying jobs that are going away, and the fear is that the effects of these cuts will ripple outwards as these individuals slash their spending. On the other hand, Chipotle says it's adding 15,000 jobs across North America. Well, based on its current level of 100,000 U.S. workers, that's an increase of 15%. And that really moves the needle. Obviously, Wiesenthal points out these jobs aren't anywhere close to the high-paying jobs at big tech. But then again, lower-paid jobs have a relatively high multiplier effect, given the higher marginal tendency to consume at the low end. In other words, economists believe a dollar of income by a Chipotle worker is more likely to be spent than a dollar of income for someone working at Alphabet making several times more. Plus, Wiesenthal adds that the macro conditions forcing Chipotle to hire more workers are also being felt by many other restaurants and smaller businesses throughout the economy, whose hiring decisions don't muster enough to make the news. Hey, more music means another break. I hope you'll stick around. We'll be back in a few minutes. You're listening to Financial Survival. Come on, baby. Don't say baby. I gotta know if your sweet love is gonna save.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Brings back some good memories of an era long past. Welcome back one more time to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. We're at 1-800-375-4188. In Friday's What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog, I wrote about three non-financial news stories that are poised to ramp up geopolitical volatility and up in markets in the coming weeks, possibly alliances as well. First, in a recurring issue with, well, I'd say, profound implications, the UN's top nuclear official warned recently that Iran now has enough highly enriched uranium to build several nuclear weapons if it were to choose so. But on and off again, diplomatic efforts for another atomic deal seem farther and farther away as Tehran provides military weaponry to Putin in his war in Ukraine, and as civil unrest shakes up the core of the Islamic Republic. Even at the height of tensions between the West and Iran under then hardline President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad before the 2015 nuclear deal, Iran never enriched uranium anywhere close to the extent it does now. For several months, experts have believed that Iran had enough uranium enriched up to 60% to build at least one nuclear weapon, even though Tehran has always publicly insisted its program is for peaceful purposes. Well, in warning the other day that we need to be extremely careful in describing Iran's program, the IAEA was direct about how large Iran's highly enriched uranium stockpile has grown to. They added, one thing is true. They have amassed nuclear material for several nuclear weapons, not one at this point. Analysts point to North Korea, which had reached a deal with the U.S. in the mid-90s to abandon its nuclear weapons program, but that deal fell apart in 2002. By 2005, and wary of U.S. intentions after its invasions of Iraq, the North announced to a very concerned world that it had actually built some nuclear weapons. For over three decades, Iranian diplomats have held out Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei's preachings as a binding religious edict, known as a fatwa, that Iran wouldn't build, much less use, an atomic bomb. Well, as it turns out, though, fatwas, I guess, don't necessarily apply to new regimes. In recent months, Iranian officials have begun openly talking about the prospect of building nukes. Official talks between Iran and the West ended in August with a final text of a roadmap to restoring the 2015 deal that Iran hasn't accepted and the U.S. withdrew from 3 years later. Meanwhile, another plot thickens. We have the bellicose Benjamin Netanyahu at the helm of Israel again, and given a new round of deadly violence in the West Bank, one wrong move by Iran could spark the PM to send Israeli bombers to Iran's enrichment facilities in Natanz and elsewhere in the region. And second, last week Israeli forces killed at least 9 Palestinians and wounded several more in a large-scale raid in the occupied West Bank, according to Palestinian officials. What some are calling the deadliest single operation in the territory in 2 decades prompted Palestinian leaders to cut security ties with Israel, a risky move that observers could say could lead to more violence. In fact, it already has. The raid in the Jenin refugee camp increases the risk of a major flare-up in Israeli-Palestinian fighting. It poses a test, perhaps a welcomed one, for Prime Minister Netanyahu's new hardline government and casts a shadow on Secretary of State Antony Blinken's trip to the region this week. And raising the stakes, the Palestinian Authority, the self-declared governing body of the State of Palestine, said it would halt all ties with security forces that they've had with Israel in a shared effort to keep Islamic militants at bay. Previous efforts like these have been short-lived, though, according to many observers, partly because of benefit the authority enjoys from the relationship and also because of U.S. and Israeli pressure to maintain it. Now, some observers say, this latest event could pave the way for Israel to step up intelligence, that police and military operations, it says, are needed to prevent attacks against its people. Hamas, which is the Islamist militant group that controls Gaza, threatened revenge for the Thursday raid. Violent escalations in the West Bank have triggered tit-for-tat live rocket fire from the Gaza Strip in the past. And this latest one is no different. Given Netanyahu's threatening rhetoric in his latest election campaign, it isn't too out there to think that, these mutually assured killings will ramp up in the neighborhood in the coming months. To make matters worse, the U.S. could end up getting dragged into this mess, however that could manifest. Money, weapons, ammo, troops, etc. And third, last week's announcement by President Biden and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz that the U.S. and Germany will send combat tanks to Ukraine was said to have been met with near euphoria in Kyiv, Ukraine. Not so much in Moscow, whose official spokespersons accused the U.S. and the West of escalating the war. Now, that's ironic. Now, tanks aren't inherently defensive weapons like the Stingers are. Pentagon officials said that the tanks will give Ukraine a critical new edge as it seeks to retake territory captured by Russia, primarily in the eastern and southern Ukraine. An advisor to Ukraine's defense minister wasted no time pushing for the next item on Kyiv's wish list, F-16 fighter jets. Hey, one can dream, right? Ladies and gentlemen, the military-industrial complex is alive and well. In fact, it's thriving. Well, our latest American Survival newsletter has once again hit the streets. I have an article on CEO pay, which we talked about a little bit last segment. Last fall on a financial survival podcast, Melody and I talked about a study showing that top CEOs made 399 times more than the average worker. According to the Economic Policy Institute report, written by Josh Bivens and Jory Condra, CEOs of the largest firms in the U.S. earn far more today than they did in the mid-90s, and many times what they earned in the 60s and 70s. The average pay for top CEOs was $15.6 million in 2021, up about 10% over 2020. And the ratio of CEO to typical worker compensation has grown to an astounding 399 to 1. That's up from 366 to 1 in 2020, and a huge increase from the 20 to 1 in 1965 and 59 to 1 in 1989. CEOs are even making a lot more than other wage earners in the top 0.1%, almost seven times as much. In fact, from 1978 to 2021, CEO pay based on realized compensation grew by 1,460%. That far outstrips S&P stock market growth over the same period, 1,063%. And top 0.1% earnings growth, 385%. On the other far side of the continuum, compensation for the everyday American worker grew by 18% from 78 to 2021. And now, as more companies are laying off workers ahead of the coming recession, not adjusting CEO's hefty pay package at the same time just doesn't look so good. Bad optics, as they say. So, a slew, but not all of these companies by far, have begun cutting their CEO pay as part of their belt tightening. For example, J.P. Morgan Chase awarded their CEO, Diamond, $34.5 million in 2022 compensation, similar to the year before, although I sort of thought that was in the $80 million, so I'm not sure this is an apple-to-apple comparison. Tim Cook is said to be taking a 40% cut this year, mainly in response to shareholder feedback. Google's Sundar Pichai said he, alongside other executives, will take 2023 pay cuts. Morgan Stanley CEO Jim Gorman will get a 10% pay cut from the year before. And then there's poor Goldman Sachs CEO David Solomon, who got a 29% pay cut last year. His pay reportedly fell more than his Wall Street counterparts. Pity the fool. More importantly, CEOs earn far more than the typical worker, and their pay, which often relies heavily on stock-related compensation, has grown much more rapidly than their working stiffs. Excuse me. Importantly, skyrocketing CEO pay doesn't necessarily reflect a rising value of skills either, but rather their use of power, i.e. power to control their board of directors. In economic terms, Bivens and Condra say this means that CEO compensation reflects substantial income in excess of actual productivity. Well, no duh. This is a big problem in terms of the overall growth of income inequality, because the growing earning power of CEOs has been driving income growth at the very top anyway. On the other hand, they point out, it also means that CEO pay can be curtailed without damaging economy-wide growth. Here are some other illuminating findings of the EPI report, even though they were first published last October. They're still notably relevant and timely today. So top CEO compensation grew 37% more than the growth in the S&P during this period, and far eclipsed the modest 18% growth in a typical worker's annual compensation, while that's over, what, the 78 to 2021 period. While millions of millions of Americans lost jobs in the first year of the pandemic and suffered real wage declines because of inflation in the second, CEO's realized compensation jumped 30% between 2019 and 2021. Typical worker compensation among those who remain employed rose 3.9% over the same period. Now, most importantly, over the last two decades, CEO to worker compensation ratio has been far higher than at any point in the 60s, 70s, 80s, or early 90s. Now, the makeup of CEO pay shifting away from the use of stock options and toward the use of stock awards. Vested stock awards and exercise stock options average nearly $22 million. That's, I believe, per CEO in 2021, accounted for 80% of the average realized CEO compensation that year. Over the last three decades, compensation grew far faster for CEO pay in 2020. It was roughly seven times higher than wages of other top 0.1% of wage earners. That's astounding. CEO compensation grew much faster than the earnings of the top 0.1% of wage earners, period. Yet, the inflation-adjusted annual earnings of the top 0.1% grew by 385% from 78 to 2020. CEO compensation grew by nearly four times as much. More importantly, the growing pay differential between CEOs and other top 0.1% earners suggests the growth of substantial income not related to a corresponding growth of productivity in CEO compensation is real. Rather, it seems to point to the power of CEOs to extract concessions. That's a power that stems from dysfunctional symptoms of corporate governance in the U.S. of A. So keep these findings in mind over the coming years. You continue to hear and read about corporate layoffs as the economy rides the bumpy road towards the edge of the fiscal cliff. The time we have for today's show, I'll return on Thursday. Butch shall join Melody tomorrow along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. Thanks as always to our producer, Todd, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning into Financial Survive. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Bye-bye.